We just heard from the editors of the new book, The Torture Papers, which collects Bush administration memos about the imprisonment of al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters, and also includes reports on conditions in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. My guest, John Yoo, wrote several of the memos in the book, including one advising that the Geneva Conventions do not apply to al-Qaeda fighters or the Taliban. Yoo was a deputy assistant attorney general from 2001 to 2003. He's now a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. In the interview that we just heard with Karen Greenberg and Joshua Dreitel, the editors of the new compilation of memos pertaining to Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and the Geneva Conventions, Joshua Dreitel said that he thinks that in a lot of these documents, the lawyers were basically asked to justify actions that the administration already planned, that they were acting like corporate lawyers, like, give us a good justification for the actions that we plan or the actions that we've already taken. And I'd really like to hear your reaction to that, since you were one of the lawyers whose memos are included in this book.
As someone who participated in reviewing these legal issues, I can say that is flatly untrue. I think this is one of the misconceptions that's been raised by people who have developed this kind of torture narrative, claiming that these kind of high-level decisions, policy discussions that were very secret and internal to the government and were not, you know, sort of part of any kind of public policy announcement, led, you know, directly to Abu Ghraib, and that lawyers were used to get specific answers that people wanted. I can say, as someone who participated in this, that people asked the question, what does this law mean? And after that, there was no kind of pressure brought to bear. There was no kind of suggestions about what answers were sought. I think what people in Washington, people in our executive branch of government legitimately wanted to do was to find out, what does the law mean? And that's important because you can't decide policy until you've already figured out, for example, where the lines on the field are. You know, once you know those lines on the field, then you can develop policy within the standards set by Congress in this statute.
On January 9th, 2002, you co-wrote a memo with Special Counsel Robert Delahunty to William Haynes, the General Counsel of the Defense Department. And this was the application of treaties and laws, specifically the Geneva Conventions, to al-Qaeda and to the Taliban who were detained and imprisoned. In other words, did we have to follow the Geneva Conventions with these prisoners? And you advised that Geneva Conventions were not applicable to al-Qaeda fighters or to members of the Taliban. Would you summarize your argument for us?
Yes, Terry. First of all, let me also say this is another example where questions like interrogation and supposed answers the executive branch wanted or the White House wanted did not really drive the decision. This was a case where the military is fighting Afghanistan, is starting to come into contact and capture people, and they needed to know what their status was. And it makes an important difference in the very basic initial way you decide to treat members of al-Qaeda, the Taliban. So, for example, just give one example, the Geneva Conventions prohibit putting people in cells, individual cells, whereas most people would say al-Qaeda members, terrorists, are very dangerous people, and if we are allowed to by law, we'd want to put them in cells. It has nothing to do with interrogations or coercive interrogations. The initial question was just how to deal with these combatants. So the basic legal issue is, are members of al-Qaeda subject to the Geneva Conventions? Are they to be accorded prisoner of war status? And I think the legal analysis is pretty straightforward. The Geneva Conventions are a treaty. Nation states sign those treaties, and they benefit from the protections for their soldiers in those treaties. Al-Qaeda is not a nation state, is not signed the Geneva Conventions. It's never declared that it would follow the Geneva Conventions. And in fact, from everything we know about the way they operate, they violate the very core notions of the laws of war. So it's very difficult to see as a legal matter why they should receive the Geneva Convention protections. Second, it was seen over the last few decades that the Geneva Conventions did not cover terrorists because they were not fighting on behalf of a nation state. So in the 70s, a group of nations got together and drafted something called the First Protocol to the Geneva Conventions, sort of an amendment to the Geneva Conventions, and did extend prisoner of war protections to terrorists. The United States in the 1980s under President Reagan refused to ratify that treaty and said it would not follow those provisions precisely because they granted prisoner of war treatment, which is supposed to be reserved for honorable warriors who obey the laws of war, to people who conducted themselves in every way to violate the very purposes of the laws of war.
What about the Taliban? Al-Qaeda, you explained. What about the Taliban?
The Taliban is a harder case, and part of it has to do with the way they fought rather than the fact that they were a non-state actor. So the Taliban, at the time of the Afghanistan war, were considered the de facto government of Afghanistan. Afghanistan did sign the Geneva Conventions. So the question is, does that automatically give you prisoner of war status under the Geneva Conventions or not? The Geneva Conventions clearly applied to the Afghanistan conflict, but the Geneva Conventions also require that in order to receive prisoner of war protections, you know, to be a POW, you have to obey certain fundamental norms of behavior. You have to, and these are all designed, I might add, to alleviate suffering to civilians, to limit the fighting and destructiveness of war to the combatants. So it's very much a part of the very purposes of the laws of war over hundreds of years. You know, first, you know, if you want to receive prisoner of war protection, you have to wear uniforms so that you're clearly distinguished from civilians. You have to bear arms openly. You have to be under responsible command, and you have to yourself obey the laws of war. And the whole point of that is to prevent combatants from blurring the line between them and civilians so that the fighting is limited to regular armed forces or to uniformed militaries and not towards civilians. Now, the Taliban, from everything we knew at the time, violated a lot of these rules. They did not wear clear insignia or uniforms. They violated the laws of war systematically. They did not try to distinguish between themselves and civilians. So in that case, what the president found was that the Geneva Conventions applied to the Afghanistan conflict, but that units of the Taliban, because of the way they operated, lost the benefits of the prisoner of war status.
John Yoo was a deputy assistant attorney general from 2001 to 2003. He's a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Yoo. From 2001 to 2003, he was an assistant deputy attorney general. In that capacity, he wrote several memos advising on the treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees in Guantanamo Bay. Several of his memos are collected in the new book, The Torture Papers, The Road to Abu Ghraib. He advised that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. Colin Powell wrote a memo to Alberto Gonzalez, counsel to the president, about the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the conflict in Afghanistan. You know, he made a list of the pros and cons for applying the Geneva Conventions to the conflict in Afghanistan. And here's some of the problems that he saw if we don't follow the Geneva Conventions. He wrote, "It will reverse over a century of U.S. policy and practice in supporting the Geneva Conventions and undermine the protections of the law of war for our troops, both in this specific conflict and in general. Two, it has a high cost in terms of negative international reaction with immediate adverse consequences for our conduct of foreign policy. Three, it will undermine public support among critical allies, making military cooperation more difficult to sustain." Do you think that those three reservations have proven to be true?
First, let me say that those kind of considerations are policy considerations, not legal considerations. You know, but, you know, first, let me address them in turn. First, the idea that this would undermine 100 years or so of American foreign policy. As I said, you know, the United States in the 1980s, under President Reagan, decided not to extend the Geneva Convention to terrorists. And so I think already had been American policy since President Reagan forward. I don't think it had ever been reversed by any subsequent president. Second, you know, Secretary Powell may or may not be right about whether it would undermine the protections for captured Americans. You know, that's a factual question. I would just point out, it doesn't appear to me that Al-Qaeda is obeying the Geneva Conventions. I don't think it ever has. I don't think that they have given any protections to any captured Americans. Instead, in fact, I think Al-Qaeda's very way of operating is directly opposed to the Geneva Conventions. They target civilians deliberately. They disguise themselves as civilians. They don't appear to take prisoners. If anything, they appear to behead prisoners that they capture, both civilian and military. So I don't know whether there's any a reasonable basis to expect any kind of reciprocal benefit for our soldiers vis-a-vis terrorists. And third, it may very well be the case that there might be foreign policy reversals or setbacks or difficulties caused by the president's decision not to apply the Geneva Convention to terrorists. On the other hand, you have to weigh that against the benefits of policy, which are being able to more securely prevent al-Qaeda members from returning to the fight and being able to interrogate them for vital information to prevent them from carrying out future attacks on the United States.
I'm going to ask you about another memo, which this one you did not write. This was by Alberto Gonzalez, who was then legal counsel to President Bush. It was a memo to the president on the application of the Geneva Conventions on prisoners of war in the conflict with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And this memo basically says that this war on terrorism is a new kind of war. It's a new paradigm. And in this new paradigm, the Geneva Conventions really shouldn't be applicable. It says, in my judgment, this new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions requiring that captured enemy be afforded such things as commissary privileges, advances of monthly pay, athletic uniforms, and scientific instruments. Can you talk a little bit about the thinking behind the idea that the war on terrorism is a new paradigm and renders the Geneva Conventions obsolete?
Well, let me first make clear exactly what Judge Gonzalez was saying there. First, he was saying that some of the provisions of the Geneva Conventions seem quaint. Wasn't saying that the Geneva Conventions as a whole ought to be thrown out. But there certainly, as you read in your description from the memo, there are a number of things that Geneva Conventions require which seem to be obsolete, which seem to probably not been followed by any of the countries that have captured prisoners of war because they're too excessive, like scientific research equipment, you know, the Geneva Convention. But there are other provisions of the Geneva Conventions which don't seem to apply to non-state actors who are not fighting on behalf of any nation. So, for example, the Geneva Conventions, as I said before, require that people be kept in barracks, not cells. You know, al-Qaeda members are very dangerous people. They're not like regular soldiers. Regular soldiers, when they're captured, are supposed to stop fighting. They're allowed to keep their usual forms of military organization and so on. They're just like players taken off the field. Al-Qaeda members want to keep playing even though they're off the field. They don't see a distinction between on the field and off the field. So, for example, it would be impractical to allow al-Qaeda members to be in a barracks by themselves. They would either kill each other, they would coerce each other not to cooperate with the government and so on. So I think some aspects of the Geneva Convention don't fit and make sense in the war on terrorism. The other point is that, you know, this is a new paradigm that we ought to think about what kind of standards of interrogation we want to employ. The Geneva Conventions essentially limit interrogation to polite questioning. So you're allowed to ask someone questions. All they're required to give you is name, rank, and serial number. And the Geneva Convention has a lot of restrictions on what you can do in those interrogations. You cannot treat anybody differently because they cooperate or because they refuse to cooperate. For example, you can't yell at interrogating the Geneva Conventions. You can't play games like Mutt and Jeff or Good Cop, Bad Cop even with people under the Geneva Conventions. So it's a very restrictive set of rules. And I think it is worth asking, do those restrictive set of rules, which were drafted in an age of large mechanized warfare between nation states, should they apply when we're fighting an enemy that doesn't have any territory, population, or cities to defend, is not deterrable, and really operates by trying to attack civilians and violate the laws of war, and so we have a greater need for information from them.
What was your reaction when the pictures of abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, of nudity, of men on a leash, of the human pyramid, what was your dogs being unleashed on them, what was your reaction to the release of those photos?
I think, like other Americans, felt I was horrified by it, and I was also saddened that, you know, that there were members of the military who did things like that. At the same time, you know, these people were not authorized to conduct anything like the kind of activities saw in Abu Ghraib, and I think that I was terribly distressed that. You know, these kind of incidents happened under the American military in Iraq.
But some of the things that happened there were allowed in Guantanamo, according to one of the memos, and including playing on the phobias of prisoners, such as phobias of dogs. What do you think of the slippery slope argument that even if the prison guards who were responsible for the abuse in Abu Ghraib were not taking orders from higher up, even if they were just, you know, loners, bad apples, that what happened in Guantanamo kind of set the tone for prison abuse, for the abuse or the torture of prisoners?
You know, Terry, I reject that notion for several reasons. You know, first, as the Schlesinger Commission, James Schlesinger is a former Secretary of Defense who led an investigation into what happened in Abu Ghraib, you know, found that none of the abuses we saw in Abu Ghraib had anything to do with interrogations at all. You know, these prison guards were not copying anything they had learned about from Guantanamo Bay. You know, he considered it completely unauthorized and illegal, and things that people were doing because there had been a breakdown of discipline and order amongst the prison guards in the facility. So first is there's no indication that any of these things had anything to do with interrogation at all. Second, the things you see in the pictures were not things that were authorized in Guantanamo Bay. If you look at what happened in the Guantanamo Bay situation, the military commander at Guantanamo Bay at the time in the, I think it's the spring of 2003, made a request up the chain of command to employ more aggressive interrogation techniques. But if you actually take a look at what they are, they pale in comparison. They bear, it seems to be, very little, if no resemblance to what happened in Abu Ghraib. So a lot of the requests had to do with playing psychological games, a good cop, bad cop regime, or at the most trying to deceive a detainee about who was interrogating them. The most that seems to be requested for was what's called light physical touching, was something like poking someone in the chest or manipulating their diet or making people get less sleep than they would ordinarily be accustomed to. All things that have to do with disorientation of the detainee. Nothing has to do with physical abuse or desire to inflict sadistic pain and suffering, which is what we saw in Abu Ghraib. You know, torture is not American policy. You know, no one is urging that we use torture as a tool to interrogate people. But I think we need to have a discussion about what the government ought to do short of that. And the problem is that the Geneva Conventions draw a line that's even far more generous than what our own police officers use in questioning American suspects for normal crimes. You cannot ask anything more than polite questions. There's a lot of difference between that and the standard torture. And so things like, you know, not letting someone sleep a lot, there's a lot of questions about these kind of interrogation methods. And I think what I want to stress is that the law doesn't answer that question for us. I think that's a policy question that we and our elected leaders need to decide, but we shouldn't try to live under the luxury that we are compelled to reach a certain result because the laws require us to. That this is something that we have to choose to do as a matter of policy.
John Yu is a former Justice Department lawyer and is a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley.